Hello and welcome to Epochs, where once again I shall be continuing my narrative of the decline and fall of the Roman Republic. Now, if you remember last time, we left off where Caesar had lost a fairly big battle at Dyrrhachium against Pompey. The civil war is now in full swing. And so the next big battle is Pharsalus, which is really the big battle between Pompey and Caesar. So let's jump straight in and let the main sources, Appian and Plutarch, tell us about how it all went down. Okay, so carrying straight on from that victory at Dyrrhachium, which Pompey, if you remember, really should have won if he'd followed up. He could well have defeated Caesar entirely. If you remember, Caesar had said, "Today my enemies would have finished the war if they had a commander who knew how to win a victory." Ooh, cutting there, Caesar against Pompey. Yeah, some people said Pompey was, sluggish is a bit unfair, but he was never particularly decisive. You know, where we've said many, many times, Caesar's thing is to be fast and quick and turn up where people wouldn't expect. Well, Pompey was never, that was never Pompey's bag. But as he's got older now, he has begun to become sluggish. So on top of never being particularly decisive, they throw on top of that a little bit of caution and you're left with a type of commander who might not follow up a victory. Okay, so now Appian tells us then, quote, "Pompey wrote to the kings and to all the cities, largely of the east, that is, exaggerating the extent of his victory and believed that Caesar's army would immediately desert to him because it was suffering from famine and demoralized by defeat, and particularly so its officers, because they feared retribution for their own mistakes. But they were divinely inspired to repent and feel ashamed for their failure, and when Caesar was lenient in his criticisms and offered to pardon them, they became still more angry with themselves, and in a paradoxical reversal of attitude, told him to make them draw lots, according to the ancestral custom, and put a tenth of them to death." They're asking to be decimated out of shame. "They agreed that they had done him wrong, and without good reason," because remember, they basically fled to the field at Dyrrhachium. They couldn't be rallied, which is, you know, quite shameful. They had done him wrong without good reason and clamoured for the standard bearers to be put to death, blaming the standard bearers, alleging that they themselves would never have fled if the standards had not already been thrown away. But when Caesar would not consent even to this, i.e. he refuses to decimate them, and reluctantly punished a few men, such a wave of enthusiasm swept over them there and then in response to his self-restraint, that they asked him to lead them immediately against the enemy. They pressed him with intense eagerness, pleading with him and promising to redeem their failure by winning a splendid victory. They turned to each other unprompted and swore an oath by individual companies in front of Caesar himself that they would not return from battle unless they were victorious. So many of Caesar's men, particularly the men responsible for breaking and running away at Dyrrhachium, are mortified with themselves. Absolutely mortified with themselves and sort of pleading with Caesar to punish them, to give them another chance. You know, just give me another chance, coach. I can make it good. And Caesar, most people say that Caesar didn't really have much choice. He might have pretended that he might have decimated them, but he wasn't in a position to, he hasn't got enough men as it is. So there was probably no way he was going to do that. He's like, okay, I'll let you fight for me again. Okay. But he actually needed every man jack of them, you would have thought. He was always outnumbered. And then to have lost Dyrrhachium to Pompey, he's even more outnumbered. So he's going to need every man in the field he could possibly get. Appian goes on. "His companions accordingly encouraged him to put such a change of heart and such eagerness on the part of the army to good use. However, to the rank and file, he said that he would lead them against the enemy were more propitious, i.e. the reality is, I can't really attack Pompey anymore. I want a big engagement, but I kind of need him to attack us. It's not going to be good, tactically speaking, if we just go and attack him immediately now. That's not going to work for me. Cool your jets a little bit. Let's not get carried away now. We're in a tight spot. We've got to do everything properly." And told them not to forget their eagerness. And to his companions, he made the point that he must first eradicate the fear of defeat that was widespread among the troops and destroy the surging confidence of the enemy. He further admitted that he had changed his mind about camping near Dyrrhachium, where all Pompey's suppliers were, when the right course was to lure them elsewhere to suffer the same difficulties as themselves. With these words, he immediately set out for Apollonia, and from there retreated to Thessaly, slipping away under cover of night. Gomphi, a small town, shut him out, and in anger he took it and handed it over to his soldiers to sack. As one would expect of men who had been starving, they stuffed themselves endlessly with everything and became disgracefully drunk, particularly the Germans, who were quite ridiculous when they were under the influence. One could only guess what Appian really meant by that. I think that an attack by Pompey then would have achieved a notable result, if out of contempt for Caesar, he had not completely neglected to follow him until he encamped near Pharsalus after 7 days' rapid marching. It is said that at Gomphi, among notable tragedies, there were to be seen in a doctor's surgery the corpses of the distinguished elders of the town, with drinking cups laying beside their unhurt bodies. 20 of them lay on the ground as if they had succumbed to drunkenness, and one, who had surely been giving them the poison, was sitting beside them on a chair like a doctor. End quote. So the leading people of this small town poisoned themselves rather than be subject to a sacking. Probably can't blame them. Appian continues, quote, when Caesar moved off, Pompey called a council of war. Afranius thought that he ought to shadow Caesar with his fleet, an army in which he was far superior, and use their supremacy at sea to harass him, on the run and in difficulties as he was. Meanwhile, Pompey himself should rapidly lead the land forces to Italy, which was sympathetic to him and clear of enemy, and after making himself master of it and Gaul and Spain, launch another attack on Caesar from a base in his own native land, the country which was the mistress of the world. But Pompey disregarded this advice, which would have been the best, says Appian, and listened to those who said that hunger would soon make Caesar's army desert to him, or that what remained to be done after the victory at Dyrrhachium would give them little trouble. So there's disagreement in Pompey's camp over the strategy. How exactly to finish Caesar off? I mean, there's three main options, aren't there, really? There's attack him as soon as possible. There's try and starve him out. And then there's sort of the super long-term view of going, you know, leaving Greece entirely, securing Italy and even Gaul and Spain. Because remember, last time Caesar had sort of flipped Spain. So, you know, go and flip that back. But, you know, who knows what Caesar might have done in that time. That would have taken months and months or a year or so or more, maybe. Who knows? Caesar's weak position after Dyrrhachium could well have been completely reversed if Pompey did that. Who knows? Who knows? But at this stage, Pompey decides that sort of, you know, the starving out option is best. Most people, most historians and scholars, and even, you know, sort of real military people that look back on this and comment on all this sort of thing, most people say that's probably the right decision. Attacking Caesar, letting Caesar meet you in open battle, that's almost certainly not a good idea, despite what just happened at Dyrrhachium. That's probably not going to be a good idea. And then this much, much long-term view, that may or may not work. That might blow up in your face, ultimately. So the safest thing to do, and probably tactically, the best thing to do would be to sort of starve him out or, you know, make them extremely thirsty and they'll just desert. They'll just give, the men will just give in. That was very common. So Pompey's probably, almost certainly, made the right decision there. You know, we'll talk about how Pompey might be getting on a bit, becoming a bit sluggish and things. But he's no fool. He never was a fool. You don't get to Pompey's position. You don't get to have had a 30 years long career or more without ever losing a battle if you don't understand war properly. So, okay, let's continue on here. Appian says, quote, also the opposite course was highly disgraceful, i.e. to leave Caesar to run away and for the winner to run away just like the losers. Pompey sided with the second view out of respect particularly for the eastern peoples who had supported him, because all those men he's raised from kings and magnates in the east, they're not just going to stay with him indefinitely, right? So, and from a wish not to risk any disaster from Lucius Scipio, who was still in Macedonia. Intending to exploit his army's keenness for battle, he came close up with Caesar and took up a position opposite him near Pharsalus, with nearly 4 miles between the camps. Pompey had suppliers coming from every direction. The roads and harbours and strong points had been so organised beforehand that he had a continuous supply by land, and by sea every wind brought him something. Caesar, on the other hand, was suffering and had only what he could with difficulty find and seize. Even under these circumstances, no one deserted him, and his men longed with supernatural enthusiasm to come to grips with the enemy. I mean, that speaks volumes, doesn't it? The degree to which Caesar's men are loyal to him is famous, isn't it? Appian continues. They considered that their 10 years' practice made them a great deal better at fighting than men who were still raw recruits, but that advancing age meant that they had less endurance for exhausting tasks of entrenchment or circumnavigation or foraging. They were tired, and on the whole it seemed preferable to them to do something rather than perish by inaction and famine. That's a classic thing. Whenever you're in a tight spot, do something, right? Being petrified is almost never the right thing to do. You've got to keep making decisions. You've got to keep doing things. You've got to keep moving forward. Otherwise, you know, you're just a deer in the headlights, which is no good to anybody. Pompey realised this and thought it risky to stake everything on a single engagement against men who were well-trained and desperate and against Caesar's famous good luck. It would be more effective and less dangerous to wear them down through lack of supplies, as they were neither in control of productive territory, nor did they have the use of the sea, nor did they possess ships to make a speedy escape. Pompey has sort of cornered them. On the basis of this excellent analysis, he decided to conduct a war of attrition and reduce his enemies from victims of hunger to victims of disease. Again, it's not a bad idea. It probably was the correct call. But he had around him a great number of senators of equal status to himself. Well, not quite equal, but still of the senatorial order. And also the leading members of the equestrian order, the kings and minor potentates. Some of them lacked experience. Some were unreasonably elated by the success at Dyrrhachium. Some also by their superiority in numbers. And some were thoroughly tired of the war and keen to put an unduly rapid end to it. They all urged Pompey to fight, constantly drawing his attention to Caesar, who kept on forming up his army and offering battle. But from that very fact, he drew the lesson for them that Caesar was forced to do this because of his shortage of supplies. And precisely for this reason, it was the right moment for them to do nothing, because Caesar was driven to act by necessity. All the troops protested against this decision because they were over elated by the events at Dyrrhachium, and so did the men of rank, who mocked him for his love of office, and said that he was deliberately delaying so that he could give orders to so many men of equal status to himself. They also called him King of Kings and Agamemnon, because Agamemnon too had kings under his command in war. Pompey therefore abandoned his own analysis and gave in to them, a victim of divine malice, both on this occasion and on the others throughout the war. Indeed, he was unnaturally slow and sluggish about everything, and prepared unwillingly for battle, to his own detriment and that of those who were misleading him. So this is a key thing, perhaps the most key thing. Perhaps the seed, well, it is really sort of the seed of Pompey's ultimate defeat, is that Caesar needed a battle. It was the only way out for Caesar, really, was for Pompey to accept battle. And then, hopefully, fingers crossed, to win that battle against the odds, against the numbers. But that was Caesar's only way out. If Pompey had just sort of blockaded him, mirrored him and blockaded him and starved him out, and as Appian says, turned hunger into disease, then there wouldn't have been a great deal Caesar could have done about it. And it was just a matter of time. But the key thing is that everyone, if you believe the account, nearly everyone around Pompey doesn't want to do that. They find that disgraceful on some level. It's like, wrap this thing up. You've already broken Caesar's back at Dyrrhachium. You've already shown that you can beat him. He's just there to be wiped out. He's there to be mopped up and finished off. Do it. Why aren't you doing it? You know, what are you, a coward? What are we, men or mice? Come on, get this thing over and done with. The quicker this civil war is over and done with, the better. The quicker any war is over and done with, the better. So why are you drawing this out? And they even accuse him of just, you know, wanting to be in command over them, wanting to draw that out for its own sake. That seems like nonsense to me. I mean, who knows what was actually in Pompey's mind, what his actual motivations were. But I personally, just personal opinion alert, I doubt that was a big factor in his mind. He's already the most eminent man in Rome. Why would he particularly care about this one command drawing out for a few extra weeks or months for its own sake? That doesn't really ring true to me. But anyway, who knows? Appian says that's what they accused him of, trying to be an Agamemnon, trying to draw that out for as long as possible. But so Pompey gives in to them. If he was a really strong leader, a strong, strong leader, you know, like an Alexander or a Napoleon type person, he would have swept that aside. You know, he would have said to them, look, who's in command here? You or me? Right, it's me. Thank you very much. So we're going to do it my way. The Duke of Wellington, Arthur Wellesley, would sometimes pull that card on senior officers under him who tried to do the tiniest thing for themselves, who showed the tiniest amount of initiative. He was, you know, who's in control of the army? You or me? Right. I issue all the orders and that's the end of the story. That's it. So don't tell me about tactics or strategy. That's not for you to worry about. Don't worry your pretty little heads about all that sort of thing. I'm in complete 100% command of the strategy. So thanks for your input. Now go away and let me do my job. But he didn't do that. Well, you know, people have always asked the question, was he capable of doing that? Was he that type of leader? You know, why did he succumb to this pressure? He was doing the right thing. Well, you know, it's easy to say in hindsight, isn't it? It's always very easy with 2020 hindsight to say, ah, there, put your finger on it, there, that was the problem. That was the mistake. But, you know, we never know at the time what will or won't prove to be a mistake. If he had just won the Battle of Pharsalus, it would have, you know, everyone would be saying, you know, Pompey was better than Caesar. Caesar would be more of the footnote from history, and Pompey would have gone down as one of the greatest military commanders of all time. But, you know, that's not how it went. But yeah, any Pompey fans out there, always disappointed by the fact that he sort of gave in to that pressure, when if he just kept on doing what he was doing, he would have won. He almost certainly would have won, it seems, to my mind. Most people agree. People like Mompson, scholars and historians who have looked at this over the centuries, all agree that Caesar had no real way out. You can only imagine when Caesar realised that Pompey was going to meet him in battle, he must have thought, thank God, thank God. Now we've actually got to win this thing against the odds, but thank God, that was the lifeline I needed. Otherwise, we were just going to get starved out here. Okay, I'll let Appian continue. He says this, quote, that night, three legions of Caesar's were going out to forage. Caesar sent them out to bring in food in the belief that Pompey was correct to hang back and thinking that under no circumstances would the latter change his plan. But when he was informed of the preparations, he was delighted at the pressure which he guessed the army had applied to Pompey and very quickly recalled all his own forces and made counter preparations. So Caesar's like, oh God, that is the moment. Caesar's like, thank God he gave in. All the men around Pompey, I mean, Caesar correctly infers that all the men around Pompey are like, we don't want to stay in Thessaly in Greece for months on end. We don't want to sit here waiting this out. That's sort of beneath our dignity, if nothing else. He offered sacrifice in the depth of the night, invoking Mars and his own ancestress Venus. The Julian family is believed to descend, with an alteration in the name, from Aeneas, and vowed, if he was successful, to make a thank offering by building a temple to her in Rome as bringer of victory. When a meteor flashed across from Caesar's camp to Pompey's and was extinguished, Pompey's companions said something brilliant would accrue to them from the enemy, while Caesar said he would descend on and extinguish the Pompeian cause. The same night, some of Pompey's sacrificial animals escaped and were not recaptured, and a swarm of bees, which are a sluggish form of life, settled on the altar. A little before dawn, a panic seized his army, and after going round himself and quieting it, he fell into a deep sleep. When his companions roused him, he kept repeating that he had just dreamed he was dedicating a temple in Rome to Venus, the bringer of victory. Because they were ignorant of Caesar's prayer, Pompey's friends and his whole army received this as welcome news. In other ways, too, they went into battle with unreasonable enthusiasm and contempt for the enemy, as though victory was already won. Overconfidence, you see, hubris. Again, easy to identify in hindsight. If they'd won, people would say, you know, they were right to be that enthusiastic, or even that enthusiasm helped them to victory. Many of them had already actually adorned their tents with laurel, the symbol of victory, and their slaves were preparing a splendid banquet. These are the richer, the magnates and members of the senatorial order he's talking about here. Some were even quarrelling with each other over Caesar's high priesthood, i.e. who should get Caesar's offices once he's defeated. Pompey, with his experience of war, turned away, and although his feelings of anger were justified, he nevertheless concealed them, and from hesitation and fear held his tongue, like a man no longer giving the orders, but receiving them, and forced to act in every respect against his better judgment. Again, weak, really. It's not what you want in a CO, a commanding officer. The commanding officer must command. You know, it sounds obvious to say that out loud, but he can't allow himself just to be swayed by people below him. Like a director or a novelist, it nearly always has to be one mind, one vision. Doing these things by a committee is almost certainly going to be in an inferior way of doing it, if not a really bad way of doing it. Okay, so Pompey acting against his better judgment. Such was the extent of the despondency that overwhelmed this man, whose record was outstanding and who had enjoyed the best of fortune in every undertaking until that day. Again, Pompey was undefeated. Caesar wasn't undefeated. Caesar had suffered various reverses and defeats over the years. Obviously, no critical ones, fatal ones, but still. Pompey's record on paper was better than Caesar's at this point. Remarkable as that is to say. Perhaps it was because he had failed to convince them of his view of what needed to be done and was gambling with the lives of so many men and with his own reputation for being hitherto undefeated. Or perhaps some more supernatural foreboding of the imminent disaster troubled him as he was about to be totally deprived of his great power that day. After simply saying to his friends, "Whichever side wins, today we'll see the start of terrible and unending troubles for Romans." He drew his forces up for battle. Some people believed that this extremely revealing remark slipped out under the influence of fear and thought he would not have surrendered his supreme power even if he had been victorious.
If you would like to see the full version of this premium video, please head over to lotuseaters.com and subscribe to gain full access to all of our premium content.